The Debrief is a production of faculty at the National Security Affairs Department at the U.S. Naval War College. The views presented here are those of the speakers and do not represent the positions of the Department of Defense or any of its components. Welcome to The Debrief, where we deconstruct defense, diplomacy, and developments in national security affairs at the U.S. Naval War College. I'm your co-host, Theo Milanopoulos. The Space Force is the United States' newest military service branch. Established in 2019, it was organized within the Department of the Air Force to secure the America's interests in space. The Space Force joins a number of organizations within the Department of Defense, operating in what is an increasingly contested warfighting domain. Here to help us navigate the United States' posture toward this new frontier is Dr. David Burbach, Associate Professor of National Security Affairs and the inaugural Director of the Space Studies Group at the U.S. Naval War College. David, thanks for joining us here on The Debrief.
Thank you very much for inviting me, Theo.
Let's start with a question about an overview of space as a warfighting domain and how the Defense Department organizes its resources and its assets to meet the challenges and opportunities associated with this new domain.
Sure. Let me start off by saying what space is not. Space, and from the DoD perspective, as much as you might like it to be, you know, think about it, I've got a my executive assistant for the Space Studies Group, a Gorn here, if you're familiar with Star Trek. Space is unfortunately not science fiction. It's not about X-wing fighters zooming around. It's not even, Space Force is not even going to be about exploring Mars or the solar system. It's really quite a bit more prosaic. And I, brought along a helpful illustration. Space in a military sense is about satellites orbiting near the Earth that provide us information and communications capabilities. For example, when you hear about SpaceX's Starlink constellation, most of those satellites operate within, by this globe, about within an inch of the surface of the Earth. Geosynchronous satellites are about as far away from the Earth as you are from me, whereas the Moon would be about 30, 40 feet away. Mars would be on the other side of Narragansett Bay. So we're really talking about, operations that are not very far from Earth, but those satellites have become an important part of our everyday military operations. The U.S. military depends on our satellite systems for navigation, for communication, for surveillance and gathering information about what's going on all over the world, for weather forecasting. And in fact, our whole economies are dependent upon those capabilities. The cell phone network or the power grid that keep us functioning every moment of the day depend on timing signals from GPS. We use these capabilities all throughout our economy. So, you may not see much happening in space, but we actually depend on this web of information and communication that is happening in Earth orbit above our heads all the time. So what we have recognized is during most of the Cold War, we were actually fairly restrained about militarization of space. We used space to collect information from spy satellites to communicate, but neither the U.S. or the Soviets went very far down the road of weaponizing space or shooting at each other's satellites. And then after the Cold War, we faced adversaries who didn't have space capability. I mean, the Taliban was in no position to try and shoot down or seriously interfere with U.S. space capabilities. Now that we're worried about conflict with China or with Russia, they are both capable space powers. They both have anti-satellite weapons, as India has also done anti-satellite tests. But we're concerned that if we were to get into a conflict, China or Russia would find it very advantageous to try and degrade American space capabilities, since that's one of our big relative advantages, and they could find it very useful. That's especially true because in, say, a scenario in the South China Sea or Taiwan, the U.S. would be playing the away game. We'd be trying to communicate literally to the other side of the globe, whereas China would be operating close to home. So we would especially depend on satellites for communication and ISR capabilities And if China were to take that away from us, that would certainly make the fight a lot easier for them. So what do we do about this? The biggest change was in 2019, we created a new service for space, US Space Force. We can talk more about exactly how that came about, what that means. But to increase the priority on space, refocus our efforts, we created a Space Force. We also, though, stood up a 4-star geographic combatant command called SpaceCom, so that everything beyond, about that to the edges of the universe now belongs to SpaceCom. So it's by far the largest geographic command in that sense. And we also did some reorganizations to add some additional focus on space with assistant secretaries and generally increasing R&D efforts in the department.
So as late as 2019, members of Congress, certain outside stakeholders, even officials within the executive branch, were not fully sold on the idea of creating Space Force as a separate military service branch. There were a couple of other ideas around creating something like a Space Corps, similar to the way mm-hmm. that the Marine Corps functions mm-hmm. within the Department of the Navy. Why was there resistance to this idea? And what ultimately changed to bring that constellation, if you will, of forces in alignment?
Sure. Although, before the creation of Space Force, before there was a real initiative for Space Force, there were a lot of ideas for what we might do to deal with this growing challenge in space. And you're right. There were proposals for a Space Corps. Some analysts like the idea of creating something like Special Operations Command, which is an unusual command that's both operational but has also what we call Title 10 authorities for procurement, acquisition, developing new capabilities. Some people thought we, could do relatively piecemeal reforms, like creating more specific space career tracks within the Air Force, or reforming some of the, creating an agency that would do space development the way we have a Missile Defense Agency or DARPA. The real factor that changed all this was President Trump coming out in favor of a full-fledged Space Force. That still had a lot of opposition. People thought it would be too bureaucratic, that a military service would require so much overhead. There are so many things a service is expected to do that you would end up spending a lot of money on things that weren't actually getting at the real problems. What changed that? A couple of things. First, we actually did get the Space Corps idea instead of a Space Force. If you look at the details, Space Force is housed within the Department of the Air Force. Its relationship to the Department of the Air Force is very much like the Marine Corps and the Department of the Navy, and Space Force is going to depend on the Air Force for a number of services like the Space Force won't have its own medics or chaplains, I believe. They'll rely on the Air Force. The key, though, was keeping the name Space Force, as far as I can tell, that was the bottom line for the president. As long as it was called Space Force, they were willing to live with a compromise. Other thing, and really what went with that, was the President Trump was so determined to get Space Force that they made clear to the Republicans in Congress that was a number one priority, and they were willing to make deals to get it. Advocates for more space capabilities in Congress who weren't necessarily a fan of the Space Force idea to begin with, recognized it's get on this train or get nothing, which is pretty typical for Congress. If a major reform fails, it's rare that Congress comes back the very next year and considers Plan B. Usually that'll kill the issue for years. So even those who maybe wanted that SOCOM for space idea thought, well, it's Space Force or nothing. And then the Democrats, who might have been likely to oppose a Space Force, were also willing to make a deal. And so the deal that the Democrats and the White House could live with was the Democrats would agree to go along with creating Space Force if the Republicans and the president went along with granting 3 months of paid parental leave for federal employees. Is there any reason that space is connected to parental leave for federal employees? Absolutely not. But it's good old-fashioned political horse trading. Both sides thought that gave them what they wanted for their constituencies, and they were willing to make that deal.
And of course, the Democrats were in the majority in the House at the time,
correct,
requiring that kind of linkage of those issues. And I don't know, maybe those deployments of Guardians, very far-flung, may require some assistance on that front.
Absolutely.
What advantages did creating Space Force as a separate military branch provide? And how does that affect things like procurement and acquisitions and these long-term efforts to really bring the United States' government resources to bear in moving the ball forward on in the technological domain?
Well, probably the biggest argument for a separate service is to create a cadre of military personnel whose whole life is about space, who will develop domain-mindedness is the term people like to use, but creating people whose expertise and all of their career track is going to be focused specifically on space. So they'll really come to understand the technologies, they'll focus on developing doctrine and concepts, so that's the main idea. And I think they're making some progress. We've already seen a number of new doctrinal publications that I think pretty smartly about space. Space Force now has its own war college program in Washington, D.C., so that they can focus on issues that they want instead of being, sort of a second-tier concern as part of the Air Force's Air University. So part of it is making, creating, an organization. It's a very classic approach. If you want to focus on a problem, create an organization whose mission is to deal with that, and where everybody in that organization, their career incentives are be good at solving this problem. Beyond that, there was hope that creating Space Force would help with procurement difficulties, where space projects tended to be, even by DoD standards, especially over budget, especially slow, and poorly coordinated, where, for example, the Air Force had new GPS satellites using a new system called the M-Code in space operating 10 years before we had receivers in the hands of Air Force and Army units to make use of that code. So we, in effect, were just wasting money and satellite lifetime because we didn't have those programs in sync. That's probably a more difficult problem to solve at a service level, because a lot of the procurement red tape and pork and congressional intervention, that's DoD-wide, or it's even imposed legislatively. So Space Force can't necessarily solve all those. It's also trying to integrate a number of, we sort of took an all of the above approach. We not only made Space Force, we created something called the Space Development Agency, also a Space Rapid Capabilities Office, all aimed at be faster and more nimble and acquire more cutting-edge stuff. Space Force is now trying to have to figure out how to merge all that and make them work together and get past just, deeply ingrained DoD culture that makes acquisition slow and difficult. So I think they're making some progress, but in some ways, that was the bigger issue that was motivating Congress, and that they're finding a more difficult problem to solve, in part because Congress makes it difficult to solve.
You mentioned the Space Command as yet another entity that exists within the Department of Defense around space. And as we know, there are some differences in mission, responsibility, incentives, organizations between a service branch and a combatant command. What kinds of tensions do you see emerging in the existence of a Space Force and a Space Command with some overlapping areas of responsibility? And what opportunities does having those two entities as separate organizations present for the department?
Well, the general observation is that following the organizational system that we've used since the Goldwater-Nichols Act in the 1980s, services are responsible for training and equipping forces. The same way that the Navy recruits sailors, designs ships, builds ships, trains people up on a ship, Space Force is going to be doing that for space. So developing Guardians, deciding what the requirements are for satellites, contracting out and build and launching those satellites. operating the forces is in the hands of the geographic combatant commands. So just as a Navy ship will be handed over to Indo-Pacific Command or European Command, Space Command, actually does the day-to-day satellite operations. They're responsible for knowing what's going on in space. Space domain awareness is the doctrinal term. They're responsible for, you know, doing things to protect our satellites if somebody's trying to interfere with them. And if we were to engage in operations against other countries' satellites, it would be SpaceCom that would be responsible. What's a little unusual is for most of the commands, they're very joint. You know, Indo-PACOM will get Navy ships, but also Air Force units, Army and Marine units. None of the other services have forces in space other than Space Force, and Space Force's contributions are almost only to Space Command. Not entirely. Like Space Force, you know, Space Force units might be deployed to help units operating on the ground somewhere with space communications, but mostly Space Force supports, provides forces to Space Command, and Space Command operates Space Force units. I think on the one hand, that reduces tensions between those two, that they are so closely linked, so the Space Command is so staffed by Space Force officers, that there's maybe, I think, less tension there than between some of the demands that, say, CENTCOM might have versus Navy, where there could be tension over, you know, are we running the ships ragged? Are we not allowing enough time for maintenance? There are people who've said, if they're so indistinguishable, do we really need both a Space Force and a Space Command? Would there be some way that we could merge them and reduce overhead? That seems maybe possible. On the other hand, experience shows that DoD is not very good at dealing with unique, unusual solutions. Sometimes combatant commands have reorganized themselves internally away from what we call J-codes, kind of literally a Napoleonic tradition of how to organize. They've all had to back off of that within a few years because the Pentagon calls up and says, I want to talk to the J-35 office. The command says, we don't have one of those. And then a four-star in the Pentagon gets angry and says, I don't want to have to look at your org chart. I just want to know how you operate. So I think if we were to come up with some kind of odd, you know, unified structure, that might just practically be difficult because we are so ingrained about how we deal with different bureaucracies. Where there is some tension is more between the military space side and the intelligence community. Historically, the intel community, you know, a lot of what we do in space, it belongs to the intel community as opposed to the military. Spy satellites with the National Reconnaissance Office. And the figures are classified, but, you know, a lot of open source estimates are half, if not even a little more, of what we spend on space is on the intel side. When we created Space Force, Congress very explicitly did not move the intel side into Space Force. There were some who proposed that. Congress decided to keep the reconnaissance office separate. And so there is a bit of tension between where are the boundaries. Just this week, I saw a news story. Space Force is looking to be able to buy commercial satellite imagery and provide that to combatant commands. The National Geospatial Agency is pushing back and saying that's crossing the line into a service that they are tasked with providing. And within Congress, too, you see the Armed Services Committees in favor of Space Force doing more and more intel, the House and Senate Intelligence Committees pushing back and wanting to protect the turf of the NRO. So that's probably the biggest bureaucratic fight that I see happening now.
Interesting. And now you mentioned the private sector. Mm-hmm. It has clearly advanced considerably in its own interventions in space. Mm-hmm. How has that integrated within the Department of Defense, mm-hmm. or even the U.S. government's operations? Mm-hmm. Is this seen as a partner with which to cooperate? Mm-hmm. Is it seen as a potential source of competition, healthy or unhealthy at times? How does the Space Force and Department of Defense more broadly create unity of effort mm-hmm. around these things, especially sure. for American-based companies?
I mean, just for historical perspective, we've always involved the private sector in that we've always relied on private companies to build satellites, to build the rockets. But the traditional method is we would have private companies build the equipment to contract, and then the U.S. government would own it. So technically, it would not be Lockheed launching a satellite, but the Air Force historically launching a satellite. And we've had close, good relationships with these firms. What's changing is the commercial side of space generally is now becoming a larger share of what happens in space than the governmental programs. And we're trying a model where we don't so much tell companies what we want, they build it to our specifications, and then we, the DoD, own it, but that we'll pay companies to provide a service, and they own everything all the way through. That's the new model that we're trying for launch services with SpaceX and then, you know, other companies that are coming online, and buying commercial communication services, even buying imagery and other intelligence products. Because on the commercial side, there have been a couple of things happening. SpaceX and other companies getting into the launch business have radically reduced the cost of launching satellites into space. It's much cheaper than it used to be. There are more options. It's faster to get a satellite up than it used to be. That opens up a lot of possibilities because if you don't have to watch every ounce of weight on a satellite as carefully, they can do more things. Or what it's really allowing, the other big change, is a move toward away from having a very small number of basically, you know, hand-built, you know, sports car, you know, race car satellites to literally having assembly lines that put out smaller, cheaper satellites and constellations where you might have hundreds or even thousands of satellites working together to provide a service. SpaceX has more than 5,000 Starlink satellites in orbit now. So we are hoping to capitalize on that by getting away from a world in which we had a very small number of vulnerable, expensive satellites, to having so many satellites that it would be difficult for an adversary to try and attack all of them at once, or we could replace them quickly. SpaceX launches about 50 Starlink satellites per week. Russia probably has fewer than 50 anti-satellite missiles total. So if they shot down 50 out of 5,000 satellites, that's 1% of the total, and SpaceX could replace that in a week. So we hope to take advantage of that, both by buying that kind of technology and relying on services provided. There are a couple of questions this raises. Elon Musk is an interesting character, and you know, he unlike most defense contractor CEOs who stay very much, you know, out of the limelight, he has had opinions on U.S. foreign policy that don't always agree with the administration. And you know, interestingly, SpaceX has been setting limits on what Ukraine can do with their Starlink service that have materially affected exactly how Ukraine fights the war. We're in DoD contracts with them. We are buying services where SpaceX is not allowed to tell us you can't use it for this. We're writing contracts with them that give us more control. But we are seeing a commercial sector that is more willing to, you know, not be, you know, kind of the quiet best friend of DoD, but sometimes have opinions of their own and manage that. Or dealing with a global commercial sector where there will be Chinese firms that are also able to provide military quality communications and intelligence services that they might not only provide to China, but could sell to, you know, Iran, North Korea, Russia. So we're having to deal with a global market, and that or even neutral countries. If, say, an Indian space company is selling satellite images to an adversary of ours, well, we don't want to attack an Indian satellite. You know, we're generally on pretty good terms with India. So can we diplomatically persuade them to maybe limit what their companies are doing? Is this just I think it's partly going to be just a new reality we have to live with, that countries without their own satellites are increasingly going to be able to buy space capabilities on a global market. And we've got an advantage, but we won't be the only player there.
And you've mentioned that these both other countries and some near peer competitors mm-hmm. are advancing their own presence in mm-hmm. space, whether it's in the private sector or perhaps on the government side as well. How does the United States and Space Force compare with the presence mm-hmm. Out there in space?
I would not trade our space capabilities for anybody else's. I wouldn't trade our space capabilities for everybody else's capabilities. We're still clearly in the lead technologically. We still have, you know, lots of operational experience. You know, if you include our commercial satellites, our dominance of the number of satellites and the number of launches into space is actually increasing because of SpaceX. That said, we do face some challenges. We're used to thinking of Russia as the other space power, Soviets and then Russia. That's not really true anymore. Russia's space power has been declining for decades. Even the 2014 sanctions had a big hit on their aerospace sector because they couldn't get advanced electronics. And they now are really finding it difficult to maintain cutting-edge military space capabilities. China, on the other hand, not only has rockets, but they have a very strong electronics and software industry. And in some ways, the important part of space is less the brute force of getting things into space, but the electronics and software of what you can do in space, you know, what you can make a satellite accomplish. And China has, they also have some capable, good launch capabilities. They're putting up satellites at a pretty hefty rate. I think by number, they may even have more military ISR satellites than we do, or they at least will soon, given their rates. And they particularly seem to be focused on, given what open source analysts can figure out about them, China especially seems to be focusing on satellites designed for maritime surveillance, which one has to assume is find the U.S. Navy in the Pacific. They're putting a lot of effort into that. So they also, Russia and China both have the ability to shoot down satellites, and probably more importantly, the ability to interfere with satellites through things like radio frequency jamming, cyber attacks, blinding optical satellites by shooting lasers at them, various things that they might do to, even if it doesn't cause a satellite to explode, will cause it to not be able to carry out its mission, which from their perspective is probably just as effective. So, I think the U.S. is in a pretty good position, but, we are facing a significant challenge from China.
Well, if I can summarize where sounds like our space capabilities are, they might be out of this world. David, thank you for being here on The Debrief, and appreciate your time.
You're very welcome, Theo. Thanks for having me.